Welcome to this summer season's Breaking the Ice. This summer, we'll be diving into discussions on the people and politics around the Arctic. My name is Leonie, and I'll be your host for this season of Breaking the Ice. Join us as we delve into the big issues facing the Canadian North and the whole of the Arctic region.
Thank you all for being here today. It's our second summer podcast that we have of our Breaking the Ice series. Today, we're really excited to have with us, let's say, two of our in-house guests. So it's kind of an in-house conversation because we have Madeline Redfern, who we will hear, but we can't see for those that will be watching the video because it's raining in Iqaluit. And Madeline, as everyone quite rightly knows, has several hats. One of them is she's the Northern Executive Director for Arctic 360, and she's also CEO for Canarctic Inuit Networks. And we are also happy to have Rob Hubert here with us today. So Rob, aside, he's a professor at University of Calgary, as most people also know, and he's also a fellow at the Center for Military Security and Strategic Studies. And we're also really happy because Rob has just come on board to join us as a senior fellow with Arctic 360. So we're really proud and happy to have him with us too. And to continue with our in-house segment for today, we have Leonie Rising, who's going to be joining me as a co-host to ask these guys some questions. And Leonie is our summer monk intern, and we are really happy to have her here and helping to be host of the whole series for the summer. And so today we're going to pretty much kick it off by talking about the recent NATO meeting that took place in Vilnius. And for maybe some reasons more than others, the NATO meeting has more interest for a wider population of Canadians, Arctic experts, and others, given the current geopolitics going around the world. And so I think we're going to kind of look at what the NATO meeting means for Canada, what it means for Arctic, et cetera, going forward. So I think we'll start by letting Leonie kick it off.
So the NATO summit, as you just said, took place on the 11th and 12th of July. And while the focus was not on the Arctic, I don't think we can really talk about NATO expansion and the Russian invasion of Ukraine without also having a conversation about NATO and the Arctic. So I just wanted to go over the big takeaways from the meeting to start out with in terms of NATO as an organization, but also the biggest takeaways for Canada.
Okay, well, if I could start, there were three really important takeaways. I think to begin with, and the one that has the greatest relevance to understanding the impacts on Arctic security was, of course, the Turkish agreement to allow Sweden to join the NATO alliance. As most people are aware, Turkey and followed to a smaller degree Hungary have been the two countries that have provided the greatest resistance to including Sweden as a member. For reasons that probably will come forward in the coming months, because it's not clear at this point yet, Turkey had changed what seemed to be a very strong position against Swedish membership. And so we now have a NATO that includes all of the Northern European Nordic countries. There is no longer a Europe that includes the Northern NATO countries, Russia, and the two neutrals. And that is fundamentally going to be changing the geopolitics of the northern regions. And I'll return to that in a moment. The second part that we saw was, of course, the efforts of NATO to appear as a solid front. And so we saw the efforts of all NATO members to basically ensure that there were no divisions, nothing publicly critical of each other appearing. In other words, we didn't have any repeats where in previous NATO meetings and summit meetings, and in particular those when President Trump was in power in the United States, when we'd see pretty strong criticisms. There were undoubtedly a lot of this behind the scenes, but the public appearance is one of an alliance together. The third aspect, and this is the one that I think people are going to be spending the greatest time reflecting upon in the long term, NATO was presented with an issue that it has never had to face before, and that is having a country that has applied for membership that in theory, everybody says they want to see joining, because you'll recall that everybody says it's a good idea to include the Ukrainians. But we've never had a situation where a country that wants to join NATO is actually at war against the country that NATO is designed to deter and ultimately fight if it attacks. So we've always had the situation when NATO was created, the Cold War was in full force, but there was not the physical hot war. NATO was created very much to deter the Soviets from any further expansion. From that point on, every single country from the 49-50 period, from that point on, every time we had a NATO expansion, a country that comes in may be threatened, may be at the front line facing the Soviet Union and then subsequently the Russians, but it has always been in the context of peace. We've never had this situation before. And so the question comes up, okay, so if we were to allow Ukraine to join right now, as we're allowing the Finns and Swedes, does that mean then we automatically go to war against the Russians? And nobody says it in that terminology, but that is really what was being addressed. The problem is do we then wait until the war is over and allow the Ukrainians to come in? And if the Russians know that that's the condition, then obviously the Russians are going to ensure that that war continues on for as long as possible. So in other words, there are some very, very complex calculations going on in how to achieve first and foremost security for the Ukrainians in their fight against the Russians. And then what is the longer term situation going against Russia into the future? And so for Canada, these three takeaways are going to be fundamental. The first one with the Arctic security is that now I think that as we move forward on other avenues, when people start talking about how do we reinvigorate the Arctic Council, I think we've just answered that question. I mean, you have to ask yourself, if you were Russia, would you really want to be coming back to an Arctic Council that now has seven members that are NATO? NATO that is making it very clear that it is going to try to even consider a country that you are in, that you've invaded and attacked, to actually be a member. And so I don't think longer term calculations about the greater security environment for the Arctic has changed. In terms of Canada and the narrative of solidarity, we saw the usual Canadian response. There's a lot of good rhetoric. Canada gives very good rhetorical responses. We're very good at speech making and saying how much we are with everybody. We did see, once again, this piecemeal policy that we seem to have. So we did have the acknowledgement that we'll be doubling the size of the troops that we have in the Baltic states. And that, of course, will be seen as a positive move. And there were other individual announcements. Another, I think it was about 500 million being given to the Ukrainians, possibly a little bit more, other initiatives, other training. So we do this piecemeal. Of course, Canada totally avoided the question of whether or not we were actually going to get serious to meet the overall 2% requirement that all NATO countries have. So we sidestepped that with these piecemeal announcements. And that's becoming the hallmark of Canadian policy when it comes to NATO. Sort of like distract everybody with sort of a flashy coin over here. Hey, look, we're doing this, and not answering the bigger question that NATO has. And the third issue is, of course, Canada had absolutely nothing to say about trying to figure out this really fundamental dilemma. How do you deal with a country that you would like to have into NATO that would probably fit within your overall context, but is physically at war with the country that you want to deter? I mean, you know, that's something that Canada just simply, I doubt that we'll ever see any response, except for the commonality. We did see the Prime Minister's office releasing statements saying that we have solidarity with NATO, we have solidarity with the Ukrainians. So once again, very strong rhetoric. What goes beyond the rhetoric really pertains to how much would we fast track the Ukrainians, and would we do so when they're in a state of war?
So this provides some really good segue into the some of these next questions. So we're talking about basically the Arctic being divided between NATO and Russia. And you're mentioning the Arctic Council and the way forward for the Arctic Council and what this actually means then in terms of reinvigorating the Arctic Council. And we know in terms of Canada, pretty much the majority of our Arctic foreign policy, we can say, had been conventionally focused on the Arctic Council. That's kind of how we look at doing Arctic cooperation, is in that context, in that sphere. And we also know that the Arctic Council is unable to address any sort of, you know, issues surrounding security and defense and that nature. That was kind of the stipulations upon it becoming into being. And so now that we have the situation where we have all the Arctic states next to Russia being involved with NATO, and then we have Russia on the other side, you know, there have been these pundits who have been speaking all along. And Rob, actually, it's funny because I'm not sure if you've been one of those, but there's been a few that have these staunch positions that, you know, the Arctic Council needs to start addressing defense issues, right, and security issues, and it needs to figure out, and if not, create some sort of other mechanism among the Arctic states that could be looking at Arctic security and defense. And so NATO itself has, you know, there is along the peripheries, right? There's this, you know, there's some papers put out, there's discussions, they look, there's the exercises that entail NATO, but there hasn't been like a full-fledged, let's say, NATO Arctic strategy. On the other side, it has been this, we're looking at NATO, this argument that we don't want to go there because that's going to actually complicate matters for the Arctic itself. And so trying to keep NATO out of the Arctic. So I guess my question would be, I mean, Madeline, you as well, for sure. So where are we thinking then in terms of defense and security when it comes to the Arctic? And so particularly when I'm thinking about, you know, is it time for NATO to have an Arctic policy? Does NATO want now to have an Arctic policy? Does it complicate matters for the Arctic Council? Does it help kind of fill a gap or do another, you know, does it help actually the productivity of the Arctic Council? And actually then also, what does this mean for Canada, given the history of our Arctic foreign policy being so much centered around non-security and military issues in the Arctic and so solely focused on the Arctic Council?
I mean, without a doubt, there has been in the past NATO exercises that have happened in the Arctic, and we see there continues to be a commitment of the members of NATO to have these Arctic exercises, effectively, you know, sort of learning how to coordinate each sort of country's or member's resources, whether it is around a maritime incident or search and rescue. These are very valuable in determining how to deploy and finding where there are those gaps. Rob and I have attended some of those types of meetings, and without a doubt, everyone sees the necessity to continue those. Is there anything that you would want to add to that, Rob?
Yeah, because you're absolutely right. And the focus of the Canadian government, and we see this clearly at these meetings that you've talked about, Madeline, has been on the issues of human security. And so the major focus is how do you respond to issues of local threats, such as forest fires, floods? How do you deal with the cultural security requirements? How do you ensure that the Indigenous peoples are brought and participate more on issues of Arctic security? And we can see the real focus for Canada on that. The problem with the addition of Sweden into the alliance now and the prospects of an increased danger, since we've said that the Ukrainians are going to be allowed into NATO. And remember, that is the reason why Putin has given for starting the war back in 2014. We can talk about what other drivers were in that context, but it was to keep NATO out. And so we are probably, after this summit, we're at a more dangerous environment in terms of our relationship with Russia. And so the paradox here is you're going to get a lot of people saying, okay, well, maybe we got to figure out how to re-engage the Russians. The problem is that you have a country that has shown aggressive action against the Ukrainians, who we now say officially will become a member of NATO, because that is the promise that was given to Zelensky. He wasn't given a timeline, but he was told that, yes, you will be, eventually Ukraine will be joining NATO. That was a very clear statement, much more clearer than what came out of the 208 summit that Putin then utilized as a means of invading Crimea and eastern Ukraine at that point in time. And so I think that the real danger now is, of course, how then do we respond and deter and act against a Russia that is actively at war with a country that we think are that is going to join NATO, and at the same time trying to figure out, okay, well, then how do we re-engage them in the context of the Arctic Council? Now, we can mock politicians and say, well, that's too complex of a problem of chewing gum and walking at the same time. But the reality is, it is an incredibly complex problem. How do you keep a Russia from basically extending this war if it thinks that its ultimate objective is being threatened by inclusion of Ukraine into NATO? At the same token, if you do extend and try to bring Russia back into the Arctic Council and other forms of Arctic governance, are you then validating the country? And so we have this problem of deterrence versus cooperation with a country that we want to say is an aggressor state when we're saying Ukraine, NATO, but we want to say cooperative state when we're talking things such as environmental security and the other issues that the Arctic Council, of course, allows us to do. And once again, it really comes down to a certain degree of your gestalt of what you think of Russia. If you do think of a Russian state that you can somehow mitigate the worst elements by bringing back into the cooperative regime of the Arctic Council, then you're going to be pushing really hard to have them back into the Arctic Council under some type of context. And that's assuming that the Arctic state of Russia wants to come into that. The other gestalt is if you see Russia as an aggressor state. And so if they're an aggressor state, and then you say basically, okay, well, you know what? We're going to turn the blind eye to what you're doing in Ukraine, Syria, and these other places. But we want you back into the Arctic Council, brethren. We want you to come back into that aspect. And that's the real issue that we face today.
True. I will say that. But I will also say, we do, global politics does walk and chew gum all the time, right? Because it talks out of both sides of its mouth, because you have collaboration, cooperation in some areas, even though you are completely against some of the other activities or ideologies that certain country has. And so I guess, one of the things to reflect on and think about, I used to always think that NATO should stay far away from the Arctic because it only will upset a cooperation piece that was going on within the Arctic Council. But then it seems like, well, if we can push kind of these security issues over to NATO and let them, let NATO kind of deal with this, could it be a mechanism to salvage the Arctic Council and to try to continue collaboration to the best of its ability? Because as we know, also then to try to actively, push Russia out of the Arctic Council, or to kind of just say, well, we can't do it anymore. We can't have an Arctic Council because of what's happening in Ukraine. Then we're going to have greater cooperation possibly between China and Russia. And so we'll see, another kind of entity, an Arctic cooperation, let's say, being created. So yeah, these things aren't easy, but we've always kept the Arctic at bay from global politics. Now it's so much part of global politics. So I guess, like anywhere else, is it possible to walk and chew gum in the Arctic?
But I mean, this gets back to some points that I've heard Madeline make in other forms, and I think it's well worth repeating, is that there's a tendency, we're blinded by the Arctic Council. Those of us that look at Arctic security, we tend to just simply see only the Arctic Council and say that is the only body. I mean, just as a side footnote, of course, I don't think anyone's saying that we're going to destroy the Arctic Council. It's a question of whether or not the Arctic Council is a A8 or an A7, just as the G8 went into a G7 and actually survived quite well. I don't think that there's any worry about that. But here's the kicker. And going back to, like I said, I give Madeline, full credit for some of the conversations I've heard her provide in terms of having a proper understanding of the full mix of international governance. And to say that only the Arctic Council is the only thing that we should be focusing on, then means that we're not paying any attention to the other multilateral institutions that are Arctic security. And people don't like saying in the same breath. They don't like saying Arctic Council, NORAD, NATO, and NORDEFCO. because they say, well, those are security arrangements. Yeah, well, yeah, they're multilateral security arrangements, and they include different combinations of the Arctic states, but they are still multilateral. So in other words, even during the period of time of so-called Arctic exceptionalism, when everybody's attention is almost exclusively focused on the Arctic Council and the Arctic Coast Guard Forum, and an understanding of what UNCLOS is doing in terms of Arctic. In other words, those are the three biggies that everyone always focuses on. But at the same time,
in Canada, because I will just say that Canada, go on.
I'd say the Norwegians and everybody that talks it. I mean, Lassie and all of our other colleagues that look at that focus on the three biggies. At the same time, NORAD, NATO, and NORDEFCO have all been developing within that same time period. And so I think that part of our problem as analysts, and this is why, you know, I always look so much for Madeline's interjections into this, but our tendencies of analysts is to say, okay, we only see these three multilateral bodies, and that's all that exists. No, that's what we're looking at. It's not what's existing. NORAD was continuing to develop during this period, particularly more on the American side than on the Canadian side, but nevertheless, we saw NATO was changing. I mean, we know that the ability of Finland and Sweden to pivot and enter into NATO so quickly was because as early as the Afghanistan war, they were learning how to operate with NATO with the idea that, well, maybe they're going to have to sooner rather than later. So in other words, all this is happening at the same time. And we tend to say, oh, we need the Arctic Council and we've got to reshape the Arctic. Well, yeah, but we have other multilateral bodies that are doing it. The problem is there is a normative element. We like the Arctic Council because it sounds much more positivist. But if we're looking at a wholesome understanding of all the multilateral bodies that are dealing with Arctic security, we need to include the three ends. You can't talk about it. And then, of course, that's where they then play. And as I said, now with Sweden as a NATO country, that affects the Arctic Council. Yeah. That's going to affect the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. You can't figure this out without thinking of those.
Yep. Rob, I want Madeline to jump in. I just want to say one thing. One thing I have personally noticed is that I do feel like Canada's been particularly tunnel visioned more than the other Arctic states. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Norway. If you look at the Nordic countries, there is still the Nordic Council has a whole Arctic cooperation. There's the Barents region. There are a lot of bilateral Arctic things that are going on that fall well outside the Arctic Council. I think that those have been ongoing. I think less so to the point of almost, not really almost at all, unless we're talking about NORAD, in Canada. It's just all of the diplomacy and the efforts have been solely focused on Arctic Council. And I think that that's what kind of put us in a difficult situation now. But Madeline, I want you to jump in.
No, I agree with Robin. There's definitely a lot more than those three entities, you know, that are convening to discuss a broad range of issues, whether it is research through organizations like ArcticNet. And of course, we can't and shouldn't forget the Inuit Circumpolar Council, which, of course, the members are part of Arctic Council. So there is a lot of different entities, sometimes with very sort of narrow or more distinct mandates. But nonetheless, there is all that work being done, whether it is on management of marine resources and fisheries and oil and gas. And of course, there's a growing concern of what is going to happen with marine mining, especially in a vulnerable area like the Arctic. You have the necessity of the Arctic region to have economic security and prosperity, because otherwise, what are you defending? You know, if we don't have the infrastructure and adequate resources in our Arctic regions, then you have that level of vulnerability. And we see that actually hyper level of vulnerability in many parts of, I would say, our Canadian Arctic, less so of the other Arctic nations, where we've seen significantly more strategic investments in infrastructure that, you know, that is integrated, whether that is in telecommunications, transportation, and energy. You need all those to serve the communities, but you need them also to develop a resource sector. You need that also for defense. I mean, we're hearing constantly from our own Department of Defense and the U.S., you know, as they're having discussions on NORAD and NORAD modernization, is that what they need is the same as what our community needs. So the goal is to see these investments to be done a bit differently than in the Cold War, where too often those investments were just military in focus rather than, you know, building out energy solutions that can help the early warning distance systems, you know, which require, you know, like the over the horizon radar system, 15,000 liters of fuel a day. So, and the mines actually produce or require more energy than most of our communities and yet are nearby our communities. So we can and should be looking at all of these much more holistically. I think we're seeing that the other countries that have been doing that have much stronger and more secure Arctic regions. And that, as we heard the ambassadors of the Nordic countries at a recent Arctic 360 conference, is that those investments in their northern regions are where they're seeing the strongest return on investments for their national GDP. So I think, you know, we can see that these investments need to be made. There's a lot of talk about it in Canada, but we're not getting where we need to be. And whether that's investment specifically for, you know, our commitment to NATO, or our commitments that we've proclaimed under NORAD, NORAD modernization, but also generally, you know, otherwise, what are we defending? You know, we've got too many kind of ghetto situations in the Arctic where up to 80% of our community members are living in poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we'll come back to the discussion of infrastructure in a bit, but so what are we defending and is it, I was in a discussion with someone, they said, well, a little bit ignorantly, well, why do we need our north? Maybe we should just give it to someone, you know. Would it be so bad if Russia took it if we can't seem to figure out how to grow it on our own, basically? We don't need to go there and get into that, because obviously if we see it, why it's so significant, and not least for where you're sitting right now, Madeline. Leonie, I think you wanted to move on, yeah?
I just wanted to briefly turn to Canada's commitments to NATO and developments within it in terms of environmental and climate security. So at the summit, there was the official signing of Canada's NATO Centre of Excellence on Climate Change. It's obviously new. What can we expect from the centre? And do you think it will help address security implications of climate change in the Arctic?
Well, I attended one of the inaugural meetings regarding setting up our NATO Climate Change and Security Center of Excellence in Montreal. And it was a very productive meeting in trying to find where those alignments are and how and why would climate change even factor into that type of mandate, and recognizing the need for investments to address climate change and how more and more of the sort of military resources are being leaned upon in these sort of events, whether it is lack of water in Iqaluit or contaminated water, or in search and rescue. Not an obvious or natural sort of alignment, but in the discussions that we had, it was often understood and seen that there can and there should be some intersection in possibly looking at, you know, where the resources need to be deployed and invested. there's still a lot, I think, more work to be done to determine exactly what that approach and that scope, you know, needs to cover. It's a little bit, you know, sort of new. I know that folks in the sort of the what we would call defense security are, you know, trying to wrap their brains around it. But I think we're getting there.
I mean, there's two factors here. I think that the creation of the center is to be applauded because it deals with the fact that we face two existential threats in the Canadian North. One is, of course, what we've been talking about throughout this discussion, and that's an expansionary, aggressive Russia. And we can put in the subtext, we can add China to that, of course. But we also have climate change. And so getting back to our sort of theme of the hour, chewing gum and walking at the same time, is that we are dealing with two very fundamentally different but equally serious existential threats to Canadians. I mean, Canada likes to think it's completely secure. And I think anyone who's followed either what is happening with Russia or have followed the climate change discussions will know that it's quite naive on our part to somehow think that we're just going to basically be able to whistle past those two graveyards and come out in one piece. And so that is an important step forward. What's going to really come out, whether or not this works, is the type of support that it receives. In other words, yes, it's important to have this type of thinking so that you're able to address these issues. But if you starve it for resources, if you are using it merely as a political rhetorical tool that you trot out and say, oh, look, we're doing this stuff, so back off about criticizing us for not being at 2%. And there's a little bit of that we've seen in terms of the most recent summit. Remember, Trudeau doesn't say anything about meeting the 2%, but says, oh, we're doubling the forces in the Baltics, which is once again good, presuming we, you know, that Murray Brewster doesn't have to do another report how we're doubling them, but we're not giving them guns or helmets, as he has reported previously for CBC. But nevertheless, so that it's not just simply proactive, performative. The same thing can be said for the Center of Excellence. Is it something that we're going to be seeing the government being able to say, hey, aren't we good? We're doing this and setting it up, but then not giving them any of the resources that they're going to need to deal with. Because each and every one of those issues that Madeline was just talking about, to get a proper understanding of it is going to be extensive. It's not something that you just simply say, let's do a Google search and we'll find a couple of good articles that Madeline has written before, and then we'll just basically plagiarize them and say, here's the report coming out of the center. That will not be acceptable. They will have to do much, much, much more in that context if it's going to be successful. But you're going to have to put it in the context of the same token that you're trying to understand all of those issues that Madeline has just illustrated in terms of environmental security threats. You're going to be dealing with an increasingly dangerous Russia. I mean, as we see Russia one way or the other, Russia now knows it can't finish this war, because the moment it finishes the war, Ukraine then joins NATO, and Russia's security ultimately is decreased even more so. So we need to realize that. That's what the message has been sent to Russia. Don't end that war, because as soon as you do, your security environment has gone down. Now, if Russia, we have also saw, and this flows back to the NATO summit, we've seen basic countries coming forward and saying, yeah, we've got to keep the Ukrainians resupplied. And that, be, you know, even Canada joined in on that in terms of the training capabilities and some additional monies that are being provided. So that aspect is, okay, Zelensky, we get it, and we're going to try, you know, we want to keep you in the fight. And so the question that we haven't asked here is, of course, and it comes directly to Arctic security, is does a more desperate Russia then start giving meaning to the threats that Putin has been given to nuclearize the war? Now, it's a terrifying thought, but recognize that the bulk of the Russian nuclear forces are in the Arctic region. They're in the Kola Peninsula. So by its very nature, we need to start thinking about that. Now, we come back to the environmental side of it and say, well, we also have to be dealing with the environmental threat posed by climate change. And so this is where Canada's contribution to this could be an important aspect, but it needs to be actually supported, and it needs to be put in the broader framework of what we're facing with in the modern in this new post-summit environment that we now find ourselves.
This is interesting, and I want to, it'll become a segue for the next question, because a lot of what Madeline, I think, is some of what she is mentioning about in terms of infrastructure investment, in terms of the security aspect. So if we're talking about climate change, how do you become resilient to climate change and address a lot of the security issues that human security, when we're talking about contaminated water and these type of issues, are a product then of climate change. And so this new center is trying to wrap its head around just the impacts of the relationship, let's say, between kind of like NATO and NATO security and climate change. So the question I would like to ask for both of you, so, and I know it's about chewing and walking, you know, chewing your gum and walking at the same time, but at the end of the day, how are we gonna kind of address the climate change issues when it comes to, and it could be a conversation within NATO, a lot of this comes back to the infrastructure investments. And I just want to ask both of you, and I like this, I like the positive comments that have been coming out about that the center has a lot of opportunity or potential, let's say. It has a lot of good potential. But can it be, is this maybe being, well, let's just have a center and then we can just, that's Canada's contribution to NATO, and then we could sidestep, a lot like what you're talking about, Robin, we could sidestep these kind of other deficits that we have when it comes to NATO, despite other areas. So my question is this, is it kind of sidestepping kind of some of these other gaps? And at the end of the day, if we could ask all of our NATO allies, Canada, if there's one thing we want from you to be of your biggest contribution to NATO, what would it be? And I'm setting it up like a straw man, I have my answer, but I feel like it would be investing in the Arctic. And so, yeah, just some thoughts on, like, is it either or, is it a scapegoat for not doing the other parts, or is this actually a catalyst to help create legitimacy for Canadians at home to make major investments in our Arctic?
That's a huge question, and I'm always cautious about anything when it's framed either or. Because then there's always sort of the concept of where investments are made or resources or priority focus. And then there's the reality is that having lived and being from the Canadian Arctic, the ore usually where you don't have those investments made. And then we live that reality. You know, it's been like that for since the Cold War, essentially. So it's, I would
caution. Can I pose it differently?
Yes.
What role can this new center play in contributing to Canada's contribution to NATO, let's say in the sphere or the realm of the Arctic? And I guess as a follow-up, is that something you think our NATO allies really want from us, is to be actually focusing more on the Arctic in the first place?
Well, the NATO exercises in the Arctic was actually recently a side conversation I had with some folks in defense about how those exercises can actually highlight where the gaps are with respect to either infrastructure or, you know, sort of resources that are needed on the ground. And that therefore, you know, sort of make the compelling case of where investments should be made, you know, which was an interesting sort of approach. There's also a recognition, at least in the North American Arctic or big parts of it, is that there's a, you know, not only a lack of actually climate change data, and because we know it's happening, but if you're trying to defend or support and strengthen the Arctic at a time where you have these dramatic climate change events occurring, where permafrost is making the ground unstable, where billions of dollars of existing infrastructure is at risk, and you want to make new investments, we need to be acting innovatively and collaboratively right across the Arctic region to find ways in which to ensure that this new investments in infrastructure is capable of being not put at risk with the climate change realities. And so it's, while on one hand, it kind of feels like as if what we might be trying to do is, you know, let's say suck and blow at the same time, I do think there is a path forward, and that it is possible to use all the vehicles, whether it's NATO or Arctic Council or Inuit Circumpolar, you know, Council, Arctic Net. I just think that there's been too much of a siloed approach, and we need to figure out how to take all these sort of bodies and all the sort of efforts and resources and find ways in which to sort of make a much stronger aligned case of what should we be doing and where, especially in the North American Arctic and Canada, where it's been rudderless. You know, we say things, and I think that's what, you know, Rob was saying earlier, is we're really good at saying things, but following through on action in a meaningful way is, we just don't have that history, at least not since the 1970s. I mean, so approaching it from, I think, that perspective, we could be doing significantly better. We must do better. I remain optimistically, you know, cynical.
I like that. Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, Madeline's answer just, I was actually saying, okay, I'm saying myself saying positive things about what's coming forward. And I'm just reflecting upon what Madeline was saying. And I just realized, where has Canada said anything in terms of its relationship of the center to, say, the Canadian High Arctic Research Station? Where are they saying anything in terms of the Canadian polar knowledge? Where are they saying in terms of how obvious areas of strength? And I'm just reflecting upon what Madeline was saying, and I don't remember seeing in any of the announcements, any of the discussions that I've been hearing, any real comprehension of being able to actually properly institutionalize what this commitment is. So here's Canada creating the center for NATO, and that's all great stuff. It basically gives the government something that says, yes, we're doing this beyond just simply doubling the troop levels in the Baltic states. And increasing the funding that we've given for assistance, the three big takeaways that come out of what the government's actually doing. But I'm thinking about in terms of how do we define what is environmental Arctic security in a NATO context? Why isn't CHARS? Why isn't Polar Knowledge? Why isn't all these other institutes that Madeline has saying, why isn't the government sitting there orchestrating some, you know, remember the so-called Arctic, I don't know if you can call it a policy that they released on the day before they actually called an election. Why isn't that champion, you know, remember that the whole essence of that, whatever you want to call it, policy, whatever they call it, was about doing it differently and bringing people together. Well, I'm thinking, you know, Madeline's so right on so much of this. Where is CHARS? Where is the Polar Knowledge? Oh, the Polar Knowledge has an amazing board of expertise and capabilities. CHARS has been doing great stuff, but when's the last time any of you have heard anything in terms of anything that the government has done in terms of, never mind bragging about what it should be bragging about, but in terms of providing any form of integration? So these bodies that you would think would be leading the charge in defining what we mean by environmental security in this context, I'm just thinking, okay, maybe there's secret stuff going on that me and Madeline and you are not aware of, and that the government actually is fully on top of this and they're integrated, and maybe I'm totally off base on that. It makes me think that what Madeline just said about the government just all talk and not actually integrating, not bringing it together, illustrates just how much political theater this is, as opposed to even taking advantage of our existing strengths and expertise. I mean, I'm of the mind, as along with some others, that because CHARS was a Harper initiative, that's the only reason why I can't figure out why CHARS isn't at the front of everything that the government's talking about. But can any of you remember the last time that the government has pointed out how good CHARS is, has utilized it as a means of saying we are going to have an understanding of environmental security that is situated in the Canadian North that we share with everyone else? I can't remember that. Can you, Madeline?
Unfortunately, no.
And, you know, and beyond that, I mean, the political, it's not just political theater, because the political theater also comes with a lot of money being dispensed. It's just, as we've been talking about, it goes right back to what we've all discussed at length at ad nauseum, is the lack of strategy. And so you have money, little money thrown out here, thrown out there, thrown out here with those announcements, but they're completely lacking any sort of larger, long-term strategic aim or goal in mind. Which goes exactly back to Madeline's discussion about everything operates in silos. And you're right. I mean, if we're going to have some kind of NATO center of excellence to talk about climate change that's located in Canada. And that's what I thought, maybe, and maybe we're just not there yet in the progression of the center itself. But, and we just, the strategy isn't there yet, but I guess the question is, will there be? I'm going to ask, I know in the context of time, I just have one quick question, and then, you know, I'll let Leonie ask any follow-up that she also maybe would like to ask, but what's the potential for just been an ongoing debate about understanding the relationship between we can't do just focus on military spending and assuming that that's going to create the social infrastructure that or the economic infrastructure that we need in the North, but like how far can we go beyond what we've done so far to be able to invest in infrastructure that's multi-purpose, multi-user, that would be able to then say this is our, you know, part of our contribution towards our 2.2%.
Well, I do think that as long as the investments made in infrastructure, you know, absolutely, intentionally, and mindfully, you know, take the security and defense considerations into account, then it can and should be counted towards NATO's and our commitment to the 2% NATO obligation. Just building a, let's say, telecommunications infrastructure that doesn't even, where the proponent hasn't spoken to the Department of Defense and the Coast Guard and the Department of Fisheries and you know, the research sector, I mean, then it doesn't really become multi-purpose. It's just like building a road, that's fine, and that you're going to have all sorts of users, but there are distinct requirements of defense. So to give you an example, on a fiber optic cable, defense will want some of, you know, sort of dark fiber, their own pairs within that, that, you know, no other traffic is aligned with it. Then you also need to look at, you know, other security considerations. So not having Huawei equipment as part of it, or who are your contractors that you're using. And, you know, all those sort of additional security, you know, considerations have to be built into it from the beginning. So when Iqaluit, we built out our port, I can tell you that was a significant $89 million investment. But unfortunately, the government Nunavut really only focused on current users. And so there wasn't the conversations that could and should have been had with, you know, the fisheries sector, because all our fish in the Arctic is landed in Greenland or in the Southern Maritimes. There weren't the conversations with the cruise ship operators, and there weren't the conversations with Coast Guard and defense. You know, again, you know, the only way you truly make anything multi-purpose is because you've done it with intention and right from the beginning, and you determine what their needs are, and then you can figure out, you know, making sure that it is truly multi-purpose, not just making it presumptive that it will naturally get used by other users, because I can promise you there are design and security elements that must be considered right from the onset and through, of course, you know, design and implementation. And then it does happen through usage.
There's something else here implicit in what Madeline's saying here that illustrates just the difficulty of this. You know, Madeline introduces, you know, and she's our one of Canada's leading experts on use of underwater cables and fiber optics and all that stuff in terms of a northern aspect. What's interesting, of course, is that when we think back to last year's June announcement of NORAD modernization, the one thing that was not included in any of the conversations or the promised monies was any consideration of protection of potential underwater cables. I mean, once the cables come in, assuming they come in, they create a security requirement, but there was no discussion whatsoever by either Minister Oren or by General Ayers on that. And in fact, when they were asked about the maritime dimension of it, they said that, well, that's going to be coming later. Of course, later is always a difficult concept whenever you hear it from any government. And so I think this infrastructure problem is so complex that you stop and you said, okay, so Madeline knows about all this stuff. And if Madeline knows about all this stuff, we know that our enemies know about this stuff. So the Chinese, the Russians all have it. And remember, recently, about a month ago, the Chinese announced that they're building a third icebreaker, and they made it very clear that it is going to be carrying deep water submersibles, both crewed and uncrewed. Well, as soon as you say that, that gives them a physical capability of interfering with our cables. Okay, so we go back and we think, okay, so the minister and the general said absolutely nothing about having a Canadian capability of protecting our cables, even though our adversaries are already telling us, yes, we're building the capabilities to do so. And so the issue of trying to project into the future the protection of infrastructure, there's another issue I think that concerns me, and that is the North is unusual in Canada. The North is the only area where at least we have the discussion about including local populations in terms of what the military is actually doing. We don't have these conversations in southern Canada. So I think it's to be applauded that in the North, at least we are far-sighted enough to think, okay, we have to include northern populations around Cold Lake or any other locations. We don't have those discussions, to be perfectly frank on this. And so part of the problem is with some of the new technologies that we're talking about, I'm not so sure that we're going to be able to have this dual use. I mean, the American sales of F-35s elsewhere to the Israelis, to the Norwegians, and I could be mistaken here. I don't want to say with any degree of certainty, but the type of security that's required, particularly in terms of hangars or just areas where they're operating, you can't have dual use. They have to be secured regions. And so, once again, I think that we also have to be careful not to raise expectations that each and every one of these is going to be dual purpose element. And that becomes a problem going into the future if we've raised those expectations. And so it's expectations management on top of ensuring that where we can ensure that, in fact, there is dual use of these different funds.
The challenge, I think, you know, Rob highlights is the fact that we struggle. I can tell you from all my sort of different engagements with especially the federal government and different departments, is that putting it into practice is the hardest part. You know, D&D, you know, says we want to ensure that with NORAD, NORAD modernization and these investments, you know, is dual purpose. I think, you know, for the large part, the military gets it. The type of infrastructure that they need is the same as our communities and the same as our resource sector. Problem is a whole bunch of other departments that are currently making millions and hundreds of millions and eventually billions of dollars in investments outside of currently NORAD don't get it. And also whether it is ICED or the Department of Environment and Climate Change, and the list goes on and on. It's not baked into their sort of DNA. It's not how they've ever operated. So they struggle with the whole concept that fiber optic cable could be a smart cable, science monitoring and reliable telecommunications, that it could have sensors on it. And that, you know, no, that's just telecommunications infrastructure. No, it's not climate change. You know, the reality is we need runways, and those runways need to be paved in order to be able to land Air Force type planes and not just our commercial airlines. And that could be beneficial for both. But it's really, really is not currently in practice any way of ensuring that our current investments or our future investments actually is dual purpose, other than just presumptively. And as I said, presumptively can sometimes, you know, inadvertently have that dual purpose outcome, but absolutely without intention and breaking down, you know, those barriers and a change of attitude and a change of priority, we won't see those strategic investments being made that will ensure dual purpose outcomes.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, just to wrap up, I wanted to quickly go back to the question on China and more specifically on Sino-Russian cooperation in the Arctic. China proclaims itself to be a near Arctic state and as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, stepped up its own activity in the Arctic, as you mentioned, with the third icebreaker. What does this mean for NATO and what does it mean for Arctic security in general that non-Arctic states are now more interested and gaining more influence in the Arctic?
Yeah, the thing I think that with our attention on what's happening with Ukraine is that we're losing sight of the fact in this period, China continues to invest in having capabilities of operating in the north. Now, a lot of attention was given, of course, when the balloons and the Chinese buoys were discovered in the Canadian north or going over the Canadian north. But there's actually been recent newspaper reports, the South China Morning Express, I think that's the newspaper, I'd have to double check, reports on the Chinese Polar Research Commission talking about the fact that they are, in fact, developing what we would characterize as a SOSA system, an underwater listening capability. And they talk about how they've actually been quite successful on this. And so put that together with the Chinese announcement about the third icebreaker. And once again, you contrast that to the fact that Canada's promised to have its big icebreaker built back in October or September 11th, 1985. And I think steel is now being cut in Vancouver, but it, you know, you sit there and you think, okay, so the Chinese, near Arctic, whatever that means, they say we're going to get a capability. So they're developing the ability, if this report is correct, of underwater listening. So they're going to be able to listen to our submarine, if any of our NATO allies, because we don't have any Arctic-capable submarines, but they're going to be able to listen for any of our allies' northern submarines. They're also going to have a capability of having an underwater deep diving capability. Canada doesn't have that in our own Arctic waters. And so we sit there and we start saying, okay, people tend to poo-paw China. It's not really, you know, they've inflate, you know, near Arctic state, whatever that means. But then I think of the third icebreaker, deep diving submersibles. I think of a Chinese developing over the last 3-4 years, a SOSIS, which is an underwater listening device capability for the Arctic, something that we've never invested. We let the Americans invest in it and do it, but we've never had, and that's not true. We have, DRC has in fact explored some elements, but we've never ever gone beyond the exploration. Well, it seems like the Chinese are. So the Chinese are going to be able to listen in the high Arctic, and they're going to be able to maneuver on an icebreaker that's carrying deep water submersibles. And for someone like Madeline, this should be very concerning because it's obviously targeting what she's talking about when she talks about underwater infrastructure. But it comes back to the point, of course, that both of us have been talking about is the government, D&D might be aware of this, but we're not seeing in terms of any formal reaction, we're not seeing Canada even playing catch up with this, let alone trying to stay ahead of the game with the Chinese when this is an issue. So your question, Leona, I mean, man, it is the question of the future.
And, you know, I'm going to jump in and now I know that because I want to actually build off of Madeline's whole discussion about multi-use, multi-purpose, and actually being able to like get outside of the silo thinking among different departments within the federal government. Because when you think about, you know, you've got Russia-China alliance, but there's also this whole piece about, in terms of our NATO allies, well, when it comes back to, so let's say critical minerals. So we know that we have a lot of critical minerals in our north, but we don't have the economic infrastructure to be able to, you know, get them out of the ground, much less process them or even, you know, get them out to market. But those critical minerals are something that are extremely important for all of our NATO allies. And it's not just for EVs. I mean, this is to build military hardware itself. So it kind of gets back to like what we need to actually build and the fiber cables that we're talking about. And so there is really a whole Arctic and security dimension to us being focused in the Arctic and thinking about the Arctic through any kind of discussion about China and going back to now, we're talking about Huawei building out the 2G in the north. And also just in terms of even social infrastructure investments. You know, when we don't do the most ourselves at home, it opens up the opportunity for others to come and invest in our own north.
So what I want to add is that we do have, you know, very smart and very capable people who are working in the tech sector, who are understanding the value and need for innovation. We've got Diana, you know, which is effectively a defense innovation sort of center that's being set up in Halifax. What I'm hearing from my conversations, though, in the innovation and tech sector, however, is that there is some awareness and some limited support at the front end. And you have to compete, and you know, there's ideas and there's minds. And so what we've done in Canada is that we open up this for a tiny number of, quote, you know, winners. And then, you know, for small, medium enterprise. But what I'm hearing is that in United States that had done a similar sort of approach had realized that they needed to actually support that innovative and tech sector beyond just the startup, you know, that beyond just the research and development, that you actually have to provide the support to allow these innovations to actually go into, you know, true business development. And what we're seeing is a massive, you know, out-migration of graduates from the University of Waterloo. 90% instantly go to the States. Those, you know, 10% who stay behind and actually take the risk of getting into business. And, you know, the startups are, you know, thankfully quite successful. But within almost sort of 3 years, a lot of these companies end up moving to the United States, where it is more attractive. And at a recent meeting I was at for Arctic Security, we had high-level U.S. state officials sort of saying that, you know, we're prepared to treat Canadian businesses as U.S. businesses. We're going to lose that last 10% when we don't have to. So it's very challenging and problematic. I mean, I'm part of, you know, a startup, and I can tell you, having faced way more bureaucratic red tape barriers and challenges that really shouldn't be in place. I mean, we just heard even recently from the head of the Competition Bureau going, Canada falls significantly further behind than most first world nations as being an attractive place to start a business, let alone, you know, just being able to take all these innovative technological solutions that we desperately need in our country, whether it is in the, you know, not just in the Arctic, but in cybersecurity and in the whole sort of like spectrum of these security requirements our country needs.
Look, just to pile on, and I mean, our good friend Heather Exner-Perrant, of course, has written extensively on this, that it's not a question of us not having the brain power. It's not an issue of us not having, I keep calling them strategic minerals. I'm showing how old I am rather than critical mineral. That was the term we used to use for it in the 1970s. But nevertheless, I mean, Heather's work highlights the fact that it's not an issue of the people, it's not an issue of the resource itself, it's an issue of the government actually putting in, despite the rhetoric it has, putting roadblocks to stop this. You know, why, you know, to connect that to Madeline's point, why are 90% of our best students going down to the States rather than staying up here? Well, it's because it is just so difficult. Why is it so difficult? Well, you know, once again, I don't want to come off as a raving Albertan, but I mean, if you see a government making it difficult for startups, making it difficult to get project approval, why would you stay here if you can find it easier in the States? I mean, you look at some other aspects of the States and you go, why would anyone ever want to go down there given the gun violence and all the other issues? But if you are pursuing a business, what does that say about us?
Yeah. Well, I will say this. Let me, how about if I say this? Because you actually kind of, maybe both of you, we can help round this off on a positive note. We have challenges, but the good side of it, or the other side, is that, you know, Canada has so much potential because, as we've said, we have a bright population, we have an educated population. We're one of the rare countries that welcomes immigration. and sees it as a huge opportunity. And I would say on top of that, we were super fortunate to have this huge Arctic that we have. And we just need to, in Canada, start thinking about innovation and potential and opportunity about our Arctic as our Arctic neighbors. As going back to Madeline's, earlier statement about how some of our Nordic neighbors talk about the Arctic parts of their own country, that's their future. And that's where the return on investment is the greatest. And that's where they're seeing, the current and potential GDP growth. And so we have huge potential here in Canada. And it's just maybe starting to look at the North as our shiny star, as our northern star, rather than always looking down and seeing it as our Achilles heel up north or something. Maybe we're just standing on our heads. That's our problem. As usual, we can go on for hours, but we will wrap up this conversation today. I really want to thank Leonie for being part of this and joining and co-hosting and leading the charge on our whole podcast series. So it's not always easy to sit in with a bunch of people and talking about the same stuff. Or, I don't know, Rob, you dated yourself. What are you talking about this for 40 years, 50 years, I know? But also, Madeline and Rob, it's been a lot of fun. So I always enjoy talking to you both. And I always learn something, at least something, usually a lot more than just something. And that today goes stands by that. So I just want to thank you both. And I will we'll see you soon.
No, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.